This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, May 10th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar.
Support for KUAF comes from Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, hosting the Hudson River School, Nature and the American Vision, featuring landscape paintings depicting a time of exploration and growth in American history. This exhibition, organized by the New York Historical Society, will be on view through September 3rd. Timed reserve tickets are available online at crystalbridges.org or 418-5700.
Ahead on Ozarks, trying to figure out what triggers conservative or liberal thoughts, plus the scratchboard art of Linda Sheets. Her work can be seen around the country.
And our regular weekly conversation with Michael Tilley from thecitywire.com is ahead as well. First, other items of note for this Thursday. A new facility dedicated to care for homeless veterans is open in Fort Smith. The Buddy Smith Home was formally dedicated this morning and is part of the Next Day Room complex. Designed to help military veterans without permanent shelter, the 5,000-square-foot building was constructed with money provided by community block grants administered by the City of Fort Smith, an affordable housing grant from the Federal Home Loan Bank of Dallas, and a donation from the family of Ralph T. Buddy Smith, a veteran of the Army Air Corps. Next Day Room officials say about 18% of local veterans are facing homelessness issues.
Senator Mark Breyer of Arkansas says he continues hearing from constituents who are concerned about a possible increase in student loan rates by July 1st. A filibuster by Senate Republicans this week blocked a proposal by Democrats to extend low rates on federally subsidized loans. If lawmakers can't make a deal, then analysts say interest rates on student loans would double from 3.4% to 6.8%. Breyer says there is agreement that something must be done.
There's about $1 trillion in student loans out there right now. This change in interest rate could affect 67,000 Arkansas students alone. There's about 8 million students nationwide that it could impact. So this is important. We need to do this. The question is, how do we find the offset or the pay for this? And there's a difference of opinion on that that's being worked on right now behind the scenes.
Breyer says in the next couple of days, a bipartisan consensus may be reached on how to pay for this proposal's estimated $6 billion cost over the next year.
May is National Foster Care Month, and the Arkansas Department of Human Services is encouraging more families and individuals to consider becoming foster parents. In 2011, a total of 8,000 children moved through the state's foster care system, with an estimated 4,200 currently enrolled at any given time. And that number is increasing. According to Amy Webb, a spokesperson for the Arkansas Department of Human Services, the state has about 1,700 foster homes in the state.
Well, we are always looking for qualified foster parents. We always need more because ultimately what we would like to do is keep children in their home communities. You know, we know it's traumatic for a child to be removed from their home, even if it's for their own safety. And so if we could minimize the trauma that they have coming into the system by keeping them in their home communities, keeping them with their siblings, then we think that would really benefit the children. But in order to do that, we need plenty of foster homes in, you know, each county. And then we also need foster homes that are willing to take in older youth and also sibling groups.
Foster parents are reimbursed for boarding, clothing, and feeding costs. Webb suggests researching fosterarkansas.org to learn more.
Supporters of an initiative to place the sale of alcoholic beverages on the ballot in Benton County are planning a massive one-stop petition signing drive this weekend. The drive-up sign-up is a final push to get enough signatures to place the question in front of voters this fall. Organizers say residents will be able to drive into a line and sign petitions from their car. Locations have been set up in Rogers, Siloam Springs, Bella Vista, and Bentonville. About 40,000 ballot signatures must be collected, and supporters say they have about 35,000 now. Benton County has been a dry county since the mid-1940s.
This is Ozarks at Large. With me on the phone from his office in Fort Smith is Michael Tilley. He's with thecitywire.com, a website that covers business, politics, culture, and more for the entire KUAF listening area. Let's begin with something of a controversy on the campus of the University of Arkansas, Fort Smith, over a series of lectures that did or did not happen.
Right, yes. It may have just been an illusion. Here at the University of Arkansas at Fort Smith, a transgender student, I don't guess that's an exact title, but Jennifer Braley had been asked to speak to a general psychology class on gender identity disorders. And she has apparently spoken to this group and other classes before. For whatever reason, Kyle, the University of Arkansas, officials at the University of Arkansas at Fort Smith did not want that held, canceled the class, and told Dr. Laura King, whose class it was, that this presentation to the class couldn't happen. Dr. King is upset. She's claiming that she's not getting a clear answer, suggests that there's a lack of academic freedom around the issue. Jennifer Braley apparently is not getting clear answers. One report from the administration said, look, we just don't have time for this now. We're in finals. We have to focus on that. Although Braley and King have pointed out that other classes were able to have similar presentations. And then the university said, well, she doesn't have the right service. She doesn't have the right forms, essentially, to do this. Although, again, she's made other similar presentations to other classes before without objection. So we've been tracking the story down for a couple weeks, and one of the issues we had is just a delay in getting response from the university. We sent them an FOI request for details. It took them longer than what the law allows, but you know we were willing to be patient on that. But the bottom line here, it's a case. It's not so much about who the student is and what the subject matter. It's a case of academic freedom and transparency and willingness to consider new ideas on a university campus.
Well, the official statement from UAFS says that while there were miscommunications, the cancellation of the class and postponement of the student speech had absolutely nothing to do with the subject matter of the student status or the student status.
Right. So, I mean, that's their statement. The Dr. King, the instructor, the professor, and Jennifer Braley, and even Melanie Stout, who's editor of the Lions Chronicle, the student newspaper, don't seem to be buying that explanation yet. There will probably be more come out from the university to better explain their position. I hope so. But, again, this boils down to academic freedom, ability to consider new ideas and concepts in an academic environment are at issue here.
Tyson Foods this week had some good news for shareholders.
Yes, good news, and that's in that sector, that's welcome news. Right now, again, folks like Tyson Foods, large companies like Tyson Foods, who buy a lot of corn and grain, those commodity prices are high. The beef processing sector in the U.S. is really taking a hit. These companies are losing every time they process a cow, they're losing money. They're losing money. And so despite all that, they were able to earn $166 million in the first quarter, in their first fiscal quarter, which was up over Wall Street estimate, about $26 million more than what Wall Street was expecting, and over what they earned this time last year. And following that, the good news from that is their share price went up, and several Wall Street firms, brokerage firms, raised their expectations on what Tyson should earn for the full year, and that speaks well for a couple of reasons. Not just for Tyson Foods, but hopefully that speaks to the overall health of the economy. I mean, if companies like Tyson, who provide basic foodstuffs and have to deal in that sector of the economy, if they're expected to do well, hopefully that reflects throughout the economy.
On the City Wire, for some time you've been following the issue of rural post offices and rural distribution centers. You have a story on the website right now from Bloomberg that kind of presents a murky future for rural post offices.
Right. This is an issue, and Kyle, you and I have talked before, this is an issue I find interesting, especially in our conservative Arkansas, where a lot of people are demanding, and rightfully so, I'm not judging the demand, demanding that government cut back, cut services, quit spending, that type of thing, get us out of this deficit. Yet when the Postal Service is okay and decides to cut rural service, cut Saturday service, we collectively lose our minds, and our congressional delegation, who we just maybe have told Monday to go cut spending, will tell on Tuesday, hey, don't let them cut our post office. So there's a schizophrenia there, political schizophrenia there that's interesting. And yes, the story on the CityWire talks about that and talks about how, you know, every time Congress tells the Postal Service to start acting like a business and then the Postal Service does that and respond, the obstacle that the Postal Service finds is indeed members of Congress. So it's damned if you do, damned if you don't. But you know, Mark Pryor, Senator Pryor, and Senator Bozeman both yesterday said that this plan by the Postal Service to keep some of these rural post offices open, not cut as many workers, consider hour cuts that they do, to not be so drastic. You know, they both said these are a step in the right direction. Senator Pryor said the Postal Service is meeting us halfway. But again, Kyle, just, and I may be editorializing here a little bit, and I apologize. It's interesting. We want our government smaller. We want it to spend less, unless it affects us individually. So when we see that, even with the 188th issue, you know, cut spending. Oh, but not our stuff.
Right. Finally, the day before yesterday, there was a study session, which some towns call an agenda setting session, for the board of directors from Fort Smith, and the subject came up about where a sexually oriented business may or may not locate in the city. And there's some history there, right?
Yes, there's some expensive history, Kyle.
You're adamant about that.
Yes, well, and this is just one of those head scratchers. You know, a lot of the things that the Fort Smith Board of Directors or any municipal board or governing body, you know, the actions they take and they consider, a clear majority of the time, us as journalists, that's interesting. We don't have an opinion on it, don't care to have an opinion. We're just following through and see where it goes. It's just our job to track them. This one's a head-scratcher, Kyle. Several years ago, the city of Fort Smith spent, or lost, however you want to look at it, roughly $800,000 to sue a strip club, Regina's House of Dolls, said it was too close to a church and this type of thing, and try to shut them down. And the courts found that the city clearly violated this business's constitutional rights. But here we go again. The city is considering an ordinance that would restrict the location of sexually oriented businesses. And again, I don't care. It doesn't really matter what Michael Tilley or Kyle Kellums thinks about where these businesses should or shouldn't be placed. The courts, the federal courts, have already established the precedent on how cities must interact with these type of businesses. But the city board, Fort Smith City Board, has essentially said, we really don't care what the courts have decided in the past in terms of access and distance and zoning requirements. We're going to enact our own set of rules. So they're essentially asking for a federal lawsuit. It's just a head-scratcher, Kyle.
$800,000 in the 90s, that's not small change.
Well, here's some perspective. You know, we've been talking about this Fort Smith Convention Center issue for a long time. That would fund convention center operations for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, depending on the convention center revenue. So, yeah, that's a lot of money. I'm not saying they're going to lose that much or they're going to get caught up in a lawsuit. I mean, they may just get a slap on the wrist, but it just speaks to the quality of governance also, and I just think that's a concern. And if they keep acting like this, it's a valid concern.
All right. Michael Tilley is the editor at thecitywire.com that covers business, politics, and more for the entire KUAF listening area. We'll see you on TV this weekend.
All right. Yes. Thanks, Kyle.
Thank you, Michael.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Iti Agnihotri Matholkar.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
Scott Eidelman is an assistant professor of psychology in the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. In a recent study, Eidelman and his colleagues discovered that when people use less effort to think, they are more likely to endorse conservative ideology. We decided to invite him to KUAF's Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to shed some light on the research findings and to tell us about how he got started on the topic.
So I'm an experimental social psychologist and spend a lot of time thinking about the way people think. And when you examine the research literature, looking at the different ways that people produce judgments, the outcomes of these judgments, there's some interesting patterns. And what I noticed is that people seem to consistently make decisions in such a way that they assume people are responsible for their actions, that they tend to prefer the way things are or the way they think they were in the past, and that they often have a deference to authority. And when you focus on these things and then map that on to politics, you see that those things tend to go along with conservative politics, conservative ideology. So really the starting point was noticing the way people think and looking at those outcomes and then making the connection between that and political opinions.
Now, one thing that caught my eye was in one of the field studies, you use bar patrons. How did you even determine that these people will make good subjects?
Yeah. So the truth is when research psychologists do their studies, more often than not, we're focused on samples of people who are convenient, who are nearby, who we don't have to pay very much money, if at all. So typically that means college students. Because we knew that we were going to be studying something that presumably was relevant outside the college student population, we wanted to make sure to try to find the population to which we might apply these ideas. So we were looking for a way to go out into the so-called real world to find some people who we could test to look for some support for our predictions outside of our laboratories. And because research shows that alcohol is a really good way to get people to maybe not think too hard or too deeply, we thought that would be a good approach.
But that wasn't all, right? You did other experiments.
That's correct. So the alcohol study is interesting because we find some support for our predictions in a population outside of the laboratory at the university, which is great. But that study is only correlational. What we find in that research is a relationship between people's level of alcohol intoxication and their political attitudes, specifically conservative political attitudes. But because it's a correlational study, we can't be certain that it's the alcohol that caused people's political attitudes, or maybe it's political attitudes that lead people to drink a certain way, or maybe some other variable, a third variable responsible for both. So it's really important to do some controlled experiments, research in the laboratory, where we can vary, manipulate who's going to rely on low-effort thinking and who isn't. And so we followed up with a few studies where we did just that.
Okay.
You know, and I know you know this, whenever you do a study like this and you publish results, anyone can start to take at it and say, you said this or you didn't say this or attack. Were there any hesitation – or not hesitations. Were there any fears that someone would get this and manipulate it to say what they wanted it to say?
Yeah. That there were fears, and those fears maybe were well-founded. We anticipated some criticism on two fronts, and both maybe again proved to be our fears proved to be on the mark. Our research is really focusing on what psychologists refer to as low effort thinking. When we're not thinking too hard, when we're not thinking too deeply, our thought processes proceed in a way that's different from when we really engage in some extra effort. And maybe a way to think of this is to consider something simple like counting to 10. If you were to count to 10, now, quickly, you could do so without too much effort. You wouldn't necessarily be aware of what you were doing. It would be a pretty easy task. If we asked you to count the second time, just like before, but this time arrange the numbers alphabetically, that would require some more effort. It's something that you've probably never done before. It would take a little time to figure out how to proceed. You'd really be engaging in some extra effort. Now, what psychologists note is that most of us, a lot of the time, use low-effort thinking. There's just too much going on in the world such that we couldn't possibly orient to all of it, have everything that's impeding upon our senses be rationally considered at all times. It's too much. And so a lot of what we do in terms of our mental activity day in and day out is probably relegated to that quick, easy stuff. And this is important to underscore, because what we're not saying is that low-effort thinking is brainless, that low-effort thought means low IQ, anything like that. To the contrary, it's probably pretty smart people who use low-effort thinking, at least most of the time. In fact, there probably wouldn't be a way around it even if people wanted to. So the first limitation, the first problem, I should say, that maybe we anticipated was that folks would misconstrue what we mean by low-effort thought.
Mm. Right. That could be a weighted sort of
term.
Misnomer. Yeah.
Absolutely. The second concern was that people might perceive us as picking on a certain people as being overly eager to or maybe inclined to use low-effort thought. And we try to be explicit about this in our research. We're not saying that people who are conservative don't think. We're saying if you don't think too hard, you tend to be, or I shouldn't say tend to be, but that initial first output is probably likely to be conservative. And to conclude otherwise really is a logical fallacy. There are many ways to be liberal, many ways to be conservative, lots of things that are relevant in determining that. What we think we've discovered or noticed in our research is that when the mind isn't thinking too hard, the default output of that tends to lean conservative.
It's so interesting.
So was this all that you set out to find, or were there any other questions that you sought answers to?
Mm-hmm. That was really our main prediction. Coming from other research, we formulated the prediction that low-effort thought would favor political conservatism. These things that I've mentioned before, people assuming others are responsible for their actions, people's tendency to prefer the status quo, people's acceptance of hierarchy. Not only do people do all these things, but it seems to be their first response, their quick response, really their default response. If they're not thinking too hard about things, if they're distracted, that sort of stuff seems to be what people come up with in terms of the output of their thinking. So all of that led us to the prediction that low-effort thought might favor political conservatism. Now, an alternative explanation or an alternative consideration is that people maybe when they're using low-effort thought, become more extreme, or maybe some other ideological response that we might want to investigate. So in all of our studies, what we focused on, in addition to conservatism, was measuring political liberalism. Many people think that conservatism and liberalism are the opposite ends of a continuum, and that may be the case. But some researchers consider these constructs to be distinct. And so in all of our studies, we measured liberalism along with conservatism to see if liberalism would be affected in the same way. In our studies, it wasn't. Moreover, in our research, when we compare liberals and conservatives to see how they respond, what we find is that everyone seems to shift toward the conservative pole. In other words, an alternative explanation might be that when people are distracted, when they're drunk, when they're in a hurry, they're going to fall back on what's habitual for them, what they're used to, the way they typically are. That certainly may be the case, but it wasn't what we found in our data. Among people who could probably best be construed as centrists, that's to say mostly college students and a handful of people at the local bar, among these people, when we divide people up in terms of who self-reports as being liberal or conservative, it appears as though everyone is shifting to the right when under low-effort thought conditions.
What's a question you might ask me in this study?
Sure. So in some of the studies, we asked people to respond to questionnaires where, we use scales that have been developed by political psychologists. Mm-hmm. So an example of an item might be the first protection in any society is that of property rights, or the United Nations should be wholeheartedly endorsed by all of us. With these examples, in the former case, we're talking about something that taps into conservatism. In the latter case, something that measures political liberalism. In our last two studies in the paper, rather than have people answer questions or respond to statements, we simply show them words and phrases that map on to political conservatism and political liberalism. So in terms of conservatism, people would respond to words like tradition, authority, status, money. In terms of political liberalism, some of those words included equal rights, United Nations, equality. And so our respondents in these studies would see these words, see these phrases, and then respond to them, again, varying the certain conditions under which they were asked to think.
Is there any support for these findings in previous research?
Yeah, we unearthed one study from the 1970s, an old study that no one had really paid attention to. And in this research, they asked, I think it was college students, to come into the laboratory and to spend a few minutes considering some ballot initiatives that they were asked to vote on, at least hypothetically. There were a handful of initiatives, and what the research varied was how much time the participants had to look over these initiatives before voting. In one version of the study, people had 2 minutes to get through them all, and there were quite a few, and so this means they had to go in a hurry and not pay too close of attention. In the other condition, participants were given 10 minutes to respond. And what that research found was that when people were given 2 minutes to respond, on average, their votes were more conservative than were those who were asked to spend 10 minutes considering the initiatives.
Hmm. Well, I have an acquaintance who I would describe as very liberal, and this person has said that they don't always study all the ballot initiatives in front of them, and when they come across one they're unfamiliar with, no. No matter what it is, it's no. And that would kind of tend to...
So we're already finding proof.
Well, I don't know if it's proof, but it's someone who is afraid of changing the status quo, perhaps.
Yeah. Some anecdotal evidence,
exactly.
Perhaps, consistent with what we're saying, yes.
Here is that question that researchers hate, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to. What can we always want to extrapolate something from this. Mm-hmm. We always want to say, okay, well, this suggests this, or perhaps this helps with this. Can we take any conclusions from this that would work to people's advantages?
Yeah. So you're right that we don't want to go too far from the data that we have in hand. What we looked at in our research were four samples, three college student samples, one community sample. Our research was done at both the University of Maine and the University of Arkansas. And so we have participants from a red state and a blue state. We have some generalizability, perhaps, because our samples are a bit more broad than what you typically find in psychology research. We don't want to overstate things, but perhaps we still can extrapolate and come up with some potential extensions. Two come to mind. The first is that perhaps it'll be easier to turn a liberal conservative than to turn a conservative liberal. That's one potential implication. But, of course, the other thing, it may be relevant to the upcoming election, there are lots of things that research understands can push people toward quick, low-effort thinking. Time pressure, distraction, alcohol, fear. And so if, in fact, our data are valid and true, what that suggests is that those sorts of conditions, putting people under time pressure, distracting people, maybe scaring them, all of these things should have the effect of speeding up people's thinking, getting them to fall back on low-effort thought, and perhaps pushing them just a bit toward the conservative end of the poll.
Scott Eidelman is an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Arkansas. If you'd like to hear more from the conversation, including what the term conservative means in this particular research study, you can go to OzarksAtLarge.com. The June Arts Festival in Bentonville is May 31st to June 30th. The June Festival includes public art installations, visual art shows, gallery walks, live music, culinary events, theater performances, hands-on kids art programs, and more. Information available at downtownbentonville.org or 254-0254. And the 2012 KUAF Fulbright Chamber Music Festival begins Thursday, May 24th at the Cilla Boyle Smith Concert Hall on the University of Arkansas campus. This six-week series offers free concerts each Thursday evening at 7:30 p.m. Performers include the University of Arkansas Music Department faculty and guest artists. A performance schedule and more information available at fulbrightsummermusic.uark.edu.
This is Ozarks at Large, and I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhokar. Linda Sheets is a fine folk artist based in Fayetteville. She is currently working on a book about rescued dogs, a project that was successfully funded on the crowdfunding website Kickstarter.com. The idea is to produce a scratchboard drawing of dogs of all the people who supported the project. I visited Sheets recently to talk about the project and her art. I also spoke with two of her very famous friends whose dogs are being featured in the book.
Some lines to a dog who doesn't see the difference. I know that you know more than I recognize, and slowly I have almost learned to read vocabulary and grammar in your eyes. But we can never be the same breed. I have to use my fingers when I feed, and you could never learn to tell me lies. Believe me a dog, my friend, but then be glad to lie down to a dream I've never had.
Poet Miller Williams is sitting in the sunroom of his home in Fayetteville. His wife Jordan Williams tells me about their three pet dogs. All three of them are rescued.
Hattie, the oldest dog, she's a border collie, I guess. We got her from the shelter, and our oldest dog, Sister, went with us and picked Hattie out as a puppy and pretty much raised Hattie, although she's a Shih Tzu and Hattie's a border collie. Sister was a mama. And then Cletus, when we got him, he was all matted up, and the groomer took the hair off, and she just held it up, and you could count every one of Cletus's bones. Somebody had just dumped him.
Hattie, Sister, and Cletus are three of more than 50 rescue dogs that will be featured in a book project Williams's friend, fine folk artist Linda Sheets, is currently working on.
This is the studio proper. So this is basically my pantry for the art supplies. So I come in here, you know, this is my encaustic station. Paints and brushes and scratchboard supplies over there. I love ephemeral things. I love things that you would have thought would have been thrown out.
We are now standing in Linda Sheets' studio. Every inch of the room is covered in her artwork. Sheets was part of the Fayetteville Underground until it closed down last year. To keep herself busy, Sheets launched a successful Kickstarter campaign this February to fund her Rescue Dogs book project. She says she studied the crowdfunding website for 6 months before finally taking the plunge.
I really literally saw photos of dogs that needed to be rescued on Facebook. A friend of mine was posting them, and I thought, I want to draw those dogs. And then from there, I just bounced to the idea of, I'm going to do a book with these dogs, you know, different people's dogs around the country, and it's going to be something that I can offer to these groups to use as fundraising. You know, either, you know, I can go and do a book signing and or give them the books or sell them for cost, and it just kind of snowballed.
Sheets moved to Fayetteville from Austin, Texas about a year and a half ago. Although she has been creating art for quite some time now, she wasn't always an artist.
I quit art school. I went to art school for 2 years, a little art school in northern Indiana. And I went to art school for 2 years and I thought, this is not going to make me a living. And my father was a plumber. My brother was a plumber. It was the late 80s, and they were taking women in to the apprenticeship. Actually, it was the early 80s. They were taking women in, and I was the second woman in northern Indiana to become a plumber.
Sheets decided to return to being a full-time artist about 8 years ago after taking care of her father, who was ill.
It really woke me up, and I thought, wow, when am I going to do art? You know, here's my dad. He's a plumber. He's worked all of his life in his 70s. And, you know, he kind of wanted to do something creative, but he never got a chance. And it was like a light bulb. And I stopped taking all the big jobs. And I still occasionally fix a sink or two. But it just pushed me into this.
She shows me a prototype of the book she'll be creating.
This is kind of what the book's going to look like. This is actually my poor dead dog, Bo. But it's going to have a picture scratched out by me of the people's dogs and then their story and a little picture of them or a picture of their dog. I'm giving them choices on what they can do.
Sheets, who volunteers with a dog fostering group in Springdale called For Pet's Sake, is co-authoring the book with Faye Barclay, a friend who's involved in dog rescue groups in Houston, Texas. Liz Lester, a local artist and designer, will help with the technical layout and design, as well as printing of the book. She says she has already finished drawing 29 dogs out of more than 50 for the book. The drawings are on scratchboard, Sheet's medium of choice for most of her artwork. She also represents the Austin company that manufactures the scratchboard she uses. Sheets is not new to drawing portraits of dogs. In fact, her most famous scratchboard art pieces are portraits of dogs and a monkey wearing a fez.
Oh, yeah, dogs and monkeys. Yeah, yeah. I believe in chasing enjoyable events and activities. I'm a responsible enough adult to embrace the things that are hard. That's all part of life. But when I can, I'd much rather be doing something that gives me joy and gives other people joy. And the dogs and monkeys, people smile when they see them, and that makes me happy.
So did she start out with drawing dogs and monkeys?
No, I started out trying to be serious. Traditionally, what a lot of people do with scratchboard are highly, highly realistic interpretations. But I looked at that and thought, that's not me. I could do it if I had to, but I don't want to. It just doesn't speak to me.
In addition to working on her scratchboard drawings, Sheets also makes collages and little wooden houses. She calls the latter vessels of memory, a memory jug of sorts. The houses are encrusted and filled with personal objects. Sheets has several of these wooden houses in her studio. One in particular catches my eye.
It has a purple heart.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And the person that had that purple heart had said to me, oh, you can paint that black. And I couldn't. I said, I'm sorry, I can't. The rest of the piece probably will be painted black with the lenses where the photographs are behind will of course stay clear, but it has a doorway that's the cover of the Purple Heart. It's such an incredibly amazing experience for me to build this for her. Her father died before she was ever born in D-Day. And he didn't even know that he was going to have a child. So this is what she got. I mean, she has very little, a shoebox full of stuff of her father's. And she saw my little houses and said, okay, you know, okay, would you take these and make them into a piece of art for me that contains a lot of these things?
For now, Sheets plans to work on getting her book about rescued dogs published by the end of this summer. After that,
I want to make this my industry. So the next project will be a cat book. You know, tentatively right now it's the dog. It's either dog and cat scratching industries or cat and dog scratching industries.
As for being recognized for her characteristic dogs and monkeys, Sheet says she has no problem at all.
I really have moments where I think, oh, God, I wish people took me seriously. I wish, you know, I was some intense artist that, you know, encrusted a skull with millions of dollars worth of diamonds and, you know, people put me on a pedestal. But, you know, I would like to be known as somebody who made art that people really, really like to look at.
Linda Sheets is a fine folk artist based in Fayetteville. She is currently working on a book about rescue dogs, a project that was successfully funded on the crowdfunding website Kickstarter.com. To find links to Sheets' work and a video tour of her working space, log on to OzarksAtLarge.com.
It is the 10th of May, a Thursday, and since it's a Thursday, I have the pleasure of welcoming Jody Beznoska, Vice President of Communications from Walton Arts Center, back to the studio. Welcome.
Thanks.
You were all over the place last weekend.
Yes, so were you, though. I saw you.
It's because Artist Fair had started.
Yeah, we had a heck of a weekend.
Trail Mix. I didn't go to the one in Bentonville, but I went to the one at Lake Fayetteville. It was a lot of fun.
It was a riot. It was a little too hot for, I think, a lot of people, but man, it was fun.
But there was a shower. There was a nice, gentle shower that occurred toward the end.
Little rain, and it was the first time I had been to Trail Mix for the past 3 years. We've been doing Trail Mix for 3 years now in Fayetteville, and I'd never experienced it because I'd been traveling or whatever, and it was so interesting. And it was fun. You know, some people knew it was coming, and so they were out there specifically to go listen to music along the trails. But I think the best part was the people who I would see biking or walking, and they would come upon this crowd of people crowded around this random place on the trail and go, "What's happening?"
And do a triple take.
Yeah, and then they'd go, "Wait a second, that's music." And that was really exciting and really fun.
Now, speaking of Artisphere and triple takes, if someone's driving down West Avenue in Fayetteville in the last couple of days, they turn over and look at Walton Arts Center, and there's a bunch of sticks.
A bit of a forest has sprouted up.
What's happening there?
Well, that is a project by the artist Patrick Dougherty. He is affectionately known as the Stick Man. And what he is doing is he is gathering saplings. We've identified a couple of special locations with the specific kind of wood that he needs. And he's gathering these saplings, and they're all being trucked to that site. And he's going to build a sculpture, basically, out of sticks. So he's going to take all that greenery that you see, and with the help of probably 10 or 12 volunteers a day, he's going to strip that greenery off that and reveal the sticks that are underneath, and then he's going to weave those sticks into some sort of sculpture. And it's undetermined right now what that sculpture is going to be.
And that begins in earnest today, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And across the street, by Nadine Baum, there's something going on.
Yeah, we're having a lot of fun with Artists in Residency right now as part of Artisphere. And so across the way is a work being begun by Massey Burke. Massey is a Fayetteville native who I believe moved out to California, and now she's come back for this project. And also working with volunteers, she's going to build another kind of structure on that space, very, very different from Patrick's work. Patrick's working in sticks. She's working in stone, in clay, in earth materials. And so she's going to build more of a structure that might look like something you could live in. And it's done with recycled materials, and it's all material from the earth. And it's really a really great juxtaposition of two different projects going on at the same time in two very different mediums.
Okay, we've talked sticks and stones. Let's talk a name that won't hurt us. It's Diavolo.
Yes. Diavolo or Diavolo.
Diavolo.
Yes. Diavolo, I learned, or Diavolo, I learned yesterday.
That.
That's okay. It's going to stick in my head now. The two pieces of that word translate dia from day and volo, which is a translation from Latin about flying. And so they put the two words together, and it's about the way the artists of Diavolo described it to us is they interpret it to mean you fly every day. The thing that Diavolo does is everything they do is based on structure. So they don't dance on a bare stage. They dance on a stage that has structures in it. And so the couple of the pieces we will see will have these massive things, this large boat-like object that rocks back and forth, and the dancers will fly off it and zip around it and everything, and they literally fly through the air, and they catch each other, and they zoom around, and it's incredibly athletic and playing with your concepts of
Gravity,
yes, and structure and how you interact with structure.
Two nights.
There's a Friday night performance that's tomorrow night.
Right.
That's at 8 o'clock, and Saturday also at 8 o'clock. These shows are part of the 10 by 10 art series as well as being part of Artisphere. So there'll be a pre-show creative conversation prior to both performances, and we'll have a post-show party afterwards in the lobby after.
What else do you have?
Oh, what else do we have? Well, we've got, all kinds of visual arts going on. We got Diavolo this weekend. And next weekend, we will have another kind of structure going up on our stage of a very different kind. Next weekend, and also during the week, we'll be doing these shows for schools. We're having a theater company come in called Polyglot Theater.
Yeah, tell me about this.
And their show is called We Built This City. Now, all of us at Walton Arts Center, as soon as we hear that, we start singing the song. I should say that that is not going to be in the show. The concept of We Built This City is this. probably about 3,000 recycled cardboard boxes have been gathered from all over the community, and the company has brought some as well. And they're going to be on our stage, and kids and their parents can go on stage and literally build a city out of these cardboard boxes. So there will be music happening. There will be a DJ there. Actors will be on stage with the kids, sort of guiding them and giving them ideas. And it's a totally different theatrical experience. Like, this is a theater company, but this is not sit in your seat and observe the theater. This is get up on stage and play.
Now, there's some interesting pricing with this show because it is adults free.
Yes.
Children.
Yes. Children are only $5 a piece and adults are free. It's meant for kids, but adults can absolutely go and experience it. The ticket is really just to, you know, make sure you come and you commit to coming. But, you know, you can walk up. The thing that's nice about this is it's not a specific start time. So we have listed that the times are from 11 a.m.
yes.
to 1 p.m. and 3 to 5 on the 19th of May. But you can come and go. So if you show up at 12, it's fine.
Right.
And if you show up at, 4:45 and you only get to experience 15 minutes of it, that's fine too. It's all a very interactive, non-structured, like a normal play would be.
And that's a week from Saturday.
That's a week from Saturday and the 19th. That same day, we will also have Patrick Doherty, who I mentioned, will be up at Crystal Bridges doing a joint lecture with Robert Tannen, who is one of the artists up there who has done the big boulders that exist throughout the space. So they will be doing a conversation together about how they look at nature through their art forms. I think that's really fascinating and really grateful and happy that we're working with Crystal Bridges on that. And that's going to take us through the 19th on the 21st of May, so really not very far away. You might want to check out, if you're a theater person or a Fayetteville person, you might want to check out Artist Lab Theater. They're doing a piece as part of Artisphere called Alley 38. And they're basically going to take you on a theatrical walking tour of some of the alley and back spaces of Fayetteville.
I think this is going to be great.
It's going to be so cool.
Christina Thomas is going to have a story on that early next week in our program.
That's going to be great. And then outside of Artisphere, on the 21st, we will have Gabriel Iglesias here. And
comedian.
That's always fun. Comedian.
Known as Fluffy.
Known as Fluffy because he says, I'm not fat, I'm fluffy. but pretty excited for that. He's one that people have really asked us for. They've wanted to see him. And I think the other thing to talk about would be The Amp. We just announced a new show coming to The Amp.
Mentioned that earlier on the program, yeah.
Yep. So Pat Benatar will be here, and her tickets for her show go on sale tomorrow, 9 a.m. And tonight, actually, if you don't have tickets yet and you need something to do on a beautiful night, it's Wilco tonight.
Right.
Very cool. Very exciting, with Purling Hiss as their guest and their opener. So all kinds of things going on in this beautiful spring.
All right. And if you wanted to see the band Five Finger Death Punch, you missed your chance.
You missed your chance. You and many, you know, there was a lot of people out
there. That's what I heard.
Yeah, there were a lot of people.
Did you go?
I did not.
Okay.
But it's really kind of interesting when we get all these varied musical art forms out there. I think it's terrific. You have country music, you have rock, you have Five Finger Death Punch, and then tonight you have Wilco.
That's
right. Great.
WaltonArtsCenter.org.
Or 443-5600 for tickets. Or if you want information about Artisphere, ArtisphereFestival.org.
Thank you, Jody.
Thanks, Kyle.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 10th of May, 2012. It's the birthday of Bono, born in Dublin, 1960. His name, Paul Hewson, the lead singer of U2, who writes almost all of the lyrics of the band's songs. It's the birthday of Belle Kaufman, born 1911 in Berlin, grew up in Odessa and Kiev, moved to New York. She's the granddaughter of the writer Sholem Aleichem. She taught in the New York public schools for 20 years and turned her career into a novel called Up the Down Staircase. 2 years ago, when she was 99, Hunter College hired her to teach a course on Jewish humor. It's the birthday of Susan Laurie Parks, born in Fort Knox, Kentucky, 1963. 10 years ago, she became the first African-American playwright to win the Pulitzer Prize for Drama, her play Top Dog, Underdog. Last year, she staged a show, part performance art, part writing project, called Watch Me Work, in which she sat working at a typewriter and the audience was
invited to watch her. And she wrote a new adaptation of George Gershwin's opera Porgy and Bess, which opened on Broadway this past January. She's working on a musical about Ray Charles called Unchain My Heart. It's the birthday of John Ronson, born Cardiff, Wales, 1967, best known for his nonfiction book, The Men Who Stare at Goats, about a secret New Age movement within the U.S. military that began in the late 70s, the Army interested in the military applications of the paranormal, the idea that it would be possible to do spying through thought, using thought as a weapon. John Ronson's most recent book, The Psychopath Test, A Journey Through the Madness Industry. It was on this day, 1869, the Transcontinental Railroad was completed. The project had been discussed since the 1830s, but people couldn't decide on the best route. Some people wanted to do a central route through Wyoming and Nebraska, others a southern route through Texas, avoiding the Rocky Mountains. But after Texas allied itself with the Confederacy in the Civil War, the central route won out. Abraham Lincoln made it one of his big goals in his presidency. He signed legislation to construct the line in July 1862. Two companies, Central Pacific building from west to east and Union Pacific from east to west. There were scandals in the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, corruption. The route went through Indian lands in violation of treaties, and the arrival of the railroad made it possible for professional hunters to slaughter buffalo. But nonetheless, it was completed on this day, 1869, at Promontory Point in Utah, and the journey from New York to Sacramento, which had taken nearly 6 months, now took about 1 week. Here's a poem for today by William Stafford, Love in the Country. We live like this, no one but some of the owls awake, and of them only near ones really awake. In the rain yesterday, puddles on the walk to the barn sounded their quick little drinks. The edge of the haymow, all soaked in moonlight, dreams out there like silver music. Are there farms like this, where no one likes to live, and the sky going everywhere? While the earth breaks the soft horizon eastward, we study how to deserve what has already been given us. A poem by William Stafford, Love in the Country, from Stories That Could Be True, published by Harper & Row Publishers, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Theater Squared's fourth annual Arkansas New Play Festival takes the stage May 18th through the 20th at Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studios. Stage readings include The Ballad of Rusty and Roy by Johnny and Troy Schremer, Uprooted by Clanisa D. Sibley, and more. 443-5600 or theater2.org for tickets or more information. And KUAF is supported by Westwood Gardens, celebrating Mother's Day with hanging baskets, garden gifts, and blooming roses at four locations in Northwest Arkansas. 442-3500 or westwoodgardens.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Kingston.
Oh, you said that with such authority. Yes, Kingston in Madison County. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Iti Agnihotri Matholkar.
Tomorrow, Antoinette Grajeda will join me. Then we'll be back together on the weekend
Sunday
edition. Sunday morning at 9. Very
Thank
good.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks a lot. Have a fantastic Thursday.